Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the November 13th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week is taking place on the White House lawn. There's Joe Biden on one side, President Trump on the other side, and they're both pulling on a piece of fabric. It's got a map of the United States. Some states are red, some states are blue, and the last five or six states that were undecided are in yellow, and it's starting to tear down the middle. The title is Refusing to Lose, Trump's Insistence that Late Biden Votes Are Suspicious. And that is, in fact, our first main story. We'll start right there. Biden leading as Trump seeks to halt count. Joe Biden appeared to be closing in on the 270 electoral votes needed to become the nation's 46th president as the week went to press Wednesday night, with President Donald Trump demanding a recount in at least one state and vowing legal action to challenge other results. Democrats' hope for a decisive Biden win were dashed on election night as Trump defied polls in state after state, posting early wins in Florida, Ohio, and Iowa. But as counting continued into Wednesday, Biden took Wisconsin and Michigan and held narrow leads in Arizona and Nevada. He remained competitive in Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania, where he was down by nearly a quarter million votes, but where 1 million mail-in ballots thought to heavily favor him awaited counting. "They are finding Biden votes all over the place," Trump tweeted. "In an election with record turnout, Biden tallied 70.7 million votes as of Wednesday, the most of any presidential candidate in history, to Trump's 67.7 million. When the count is finished, we believe we will be the winners," Biden said. Speaking from the White House, Trump declared victory and called the vote counting a fraud on the American people. He vowed to petition the Supreme Court to intervene in the states, though there's no legal mechanism for his campaign to appeal directly to the high court. Campaign manager Bill Stepien said the campaign would seek a recount in Wisconsin, where Trump trailed by about one percentage point, and would file suit to stop the counting of ballots in Michigan and Pennsylvania. "If we count all legal ballots, the president wins," said Stepien. Despite wide concerns about potential violence and voter intimidation that had law enforcement officials on high alert, Election Day unfolded without serious incident. As expected, Biden polled well among urban voters, suburban women, young voters, African Americans, and college graduates. Trump expanded his edge with white rural voters and did surprisingly well with Hispanics. In exit polling, voters who cited the economy as the most important issue heavily favored Trump, while those who cited the coronavirus pandemic leaned toward Biden. What the editorial said: Trump's laughably ignorant claims to the contrary. "Counting always goes on past Election Day," said the Los Angeles Times. Biden's late rising numbers had been widely predicted as mail ballots were counted, but Trump falsely claimed they were suspicious. The record turnout was a tribute to Americans' engagement in this pivotal election, and we must count every vote. "So much for the landslide," said the Wall Street Journal. While the winner is still up in the air, it's clear the biggest early losers are the pollsters. The failure of the anticipated blue wave reminds us that democracy is surprising and humility is good journalism practice. We'll long be talking about where the pollsters and pundits went wrong, but we'd bet one factor was a strong pre-pandemic economy that lifted wages for low-skilled workers. What the columnist said. Let's face it, said John Podhoretz in the New York Post, political polling is a fraud. Pollsters' seductive promise is to make a science of understanding a complex and changing set of circumstances. But after the third election in which Florida polling was almost comically wrong, this time by 7 to 9 points, it's clear they claim to quantify something that cannot accurately be measured. Why do we keep listening? For progressives, the closeness of this election is shocking, said Michael Tomasky in the Daily Beast. We couldn't fathom that anyone could look at Trump's train wreck of a record and sign up for more. With nearly 250,000 people dead from a bungled pandemic and 4 years of norm-shattering incompetence and corruption, the idea that 70-something million people could vote for this man is beyond belief. In the end, it came down to tribalism, said Margaret Sullivan in the Washington Post. Trump's unshakable support points to one of his great achievements, turning huge swaths of the country against nuanced fact and toward the comforting simplicity of the tribe. Trump's disgraceful, evidence-free claims of fraud represent the gravest of threats to the stability of the country, said Dan Baltz in the Washington Post. He's given his followers license to see anything other than a Trump victory as a stolen election. The damage cannot be overstated. Blindsided Democrats should do some soul-searching, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. Maybe it's time to stop assuming that they have African Americans and Latinos locked up. Stop calling opponents racist and demonizing pro-lifers. Acknowledge a difference between legal and illegal immigration and call a riot a riot. And here's the craziest thought of all. Maybe they should try to talk to and understand people who disagree with them instead of dismissing them as deplorables. After all, Trump voters make up about half the country. What next? Even if he pulls out a win, Biden looks screwed, said Ryan Lietza in Politico.com. Without a crushing rejection of Trump, Democrats will not get the political realignment they had hoped for, akin to what Ronald Reagan achieved when he beat one-termer Jimmy Carter and ushered in an era of modern conservatism. Nor are there any signs Biden has assembled a new coalition the way Obama did. And if Republicans hold the Senate, they'll hamstring a President Biden from day one. Trumpism will remain alive and well even if Trump narrowly loses, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Republicans will have very little reason to jettison their anti-government venom or their aversion to fact-based politics. And the parallel universe of right-wing media is not evaporating anytime soon. That will pose an immense challenge for a president who ran as a conciliator. Years more of dysfunction and gridlock, rather than an era of progressive reform, could be in the offing. On our controversy of the week, we have the election. Why so many Hispanics backed Trump? We may not fully understand for weeks why the pollsters once again bungled a presidential election, but one point is already clear, said Sabrina Rodriguez in Politico.com. They badly underestimated Donald Trump's support among Hispanics. On election night, returns from Florida's heavily Hispanic Miami-Dade County showed Joe Biden leading Trump by only 7.3%, a shocking drop-off from the 29.4% by which Hillary Clinton blew Trump away in 2016. Democrats tried blaming the shift on Miami's unique population of Cuban and Venezuelan exiles, whom Trump has targeted with 4 years of nonstop outreach and dire warnings that Biden would turn the U.S. into a socialist dystopia like the ones they'd fled. But as more numbers rolled in, it became clear that Miami-Dade was not unique, said Tiana Lowe in WashingtonExaminer.com. Biden underperformed Clinton's share of the Hispanic vote not only in Florida, but also in Texas, Georgia, and Ohio. Trump, exit polls suggested, won about 36% of the national Hispanic vote. For years, the conventional wisdom has held that the growing Hispanic population would eventually doom Republicans to permanent minority status. But as of this dramatic week, racial demographics are no longer destiny. Democrats made a condescending miscalculation, said Christian Paz in TheAtlantic.com. They figured that after 4 years of Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric, Hispanics would troop en masse to the polls and vote him out. Some of them surely did. Biden's 30-point Hispanic advantage over Trump in Arizona helped flip that state blue for the first time since 1996. But many Hispanics who've been in the U.S. for years, or even generations, simply don't identify with the plight of Latin American immigrants today. They see themselves as American first, with many rejecting the woke label Latinx and even Latino. And they believed Trump's warnings that unregulated immigration could have a negative effect on their own well-being. Hispanics tend to be family-oriented, religious, hardworking, and often run small businesses, said Tim Stanley in the Telegraph. That made them a natural fit for Trump's populist coalition. About 30% of Hispanics have reliably voted Republican for decades, said Jeet Heater in TheNation.com. Trump did a good job of turning them out. But the real story here is Biden's failure to motivate his own larger Hispanic base. Progressive activists have been warning that Biden wasn't spending the money or hiring the staff needed to get Latino Democrats to the polls. His tepid centrist message may have helped woo a few erstwhile Republicans, but Hispanics' strong preference for Bernie Sanders during the primaries was a compelling clue that Biden needed a robust dose of economic populism. Don't oversimplify these results, said Ruben Navarrete Jr. in TheDailyBeast.com. Biden won 8 of the 10 most Hispanic states in the nation and did well with Mexican Americans. But Hispanics were treated as an afterthought by Democrats, who focused far more on wooing African Americans. The lesson is that Latino voters are more complicated than most people thought and can decide elections. In some states, the Latino vote helped Trump. In others, it helped Biden, said Jorge Galindo in Spain's El País. This should disprove the longstanding claim that Hispanics resist cultural assimilation. The 2020 election has shown that Hispanics can be just as polarized as the rest of a divided nation. Here's our good week, bad week segment. Seems it was a good week for rehabs. After Google searches found liquor store near me hit an all-time high on election night, searches for anxiety and move to Canada also skyrocketed. It was a good week, bad week for Baby Shark. After a video for the preschool mega hit that parents love to hate surpassed Luis Fonsi's Despacito to become the most viewed video in YouTube history, with a mind-numbing 7.038 billion views. Finally, it was a good week for humans. After Walmart decided to lay off hundreds of six-foot-tall robots it had been using to scan inventory in 500 of its stores, the company decided flesh-and-blood workers did this more efficiently and intelligently, and was concerned that customers were unsettled by coming upon robots in the housewares aisle. But it was a bad week for office romances after the New York Post reported that a state trooper Garden Governor Andrew Cuomo began dating his daughter, Kara, 25, and was then transferred to an outpost more than 150 miles away, near the Canadian border. It was a bad week for magical thinking, with reports that two con men in Uttar Pradesh, India, tricked a doctor into paying $94,000 for an Aladdin-style magic lamp containing a wish-granting genie. The genie, said police, was one of the men in disguise. And it was a bad week for American exceptionalism after the United States became the first nation on Earth to report more than 100,000 new cases of COVID-19 in a single day. The U.S. single-day total of 1,233 smashes India's previous record of 97,894. Short news piece before we go. Trump virus expert used by Russians. The White House coronavirus advisor, Dr. Scott Atlas, apologized this week after giving an interview to a Russian state-sponsored news organization long known for spreading conspiracy theories. During the half-hour interview with the RT Network, originally known as Russia Today, Atlas, who has called for letting the coronavirus spread naturally to achieve herd immunity, claimed that coronavirus restrictions are killing people. He later said he was unaware that RT is registered as a foreign agent and considered by U.S. intelligence agencies to be a propaganda arm of the Russian government. The network was created by Russian President Vladimir Putin and notoriously peddled the conspiracy theory in 2009 that H1N1 swine flu was bioengineered by the U.S. military. The title of our briefing page article is The Debate Over the 1619 Project. The reframing of U.S. history around slavery and racism continues to draw ferocious opposition. What is the 1619 Project? It was a New York Times Magazine special issue last year marking the 400th anniversary of American slavery, in which the Times proposed regarding 1619 as our nation's birth year. In August of that year, about 20 slaves from present-day Angola were sold in chains to British colonists in Jamestown, Virginia. The establishment of slavery in the British colonies, the Times argued, was as formative to U.S. history as the signing of the Declaration of Independence in 1776. The new nation was more slavocracy than democracy, staff writer Nicole Hannah-Jones wrote in a Pulitzer Prize-winning opening essay, arguing that the founding ideals of equality and liberty were a lie. Other articles in the 1619 Project trace the influence of slavery on modern-day diets, politics, criminal justice, health care, capitalism, even traffic patterns in Atlanta. The issue spawned podcasts and upcoming Oprah Winfrey-backed films and TV shows, and hundreds of thousands of copies were sent to libraries and schools. It quickly became a new front in the culture war. In June, protesters spray painted 1619 across a toppled statue of George Washington, while President Trump and Fox News frequently deride the project as an attack on America itself. What are the most controversial claims? The Times argued that progress toward racial equality is stunted because anti-black racism runs in the very DNA of this country. Hannah Jones wrote that an American racial caste system was put in place before the nation's founding and that one of the primary reasons colonists declared independence from Britain was because they wanted to protect the institution of slavery. White men like Thomas Jefferson, who drafted the Declaration with a black slave waiting on him, were empowered to break from the British Empire because of dizzying profits generated by chattel slavery, she wrote. Black Americans, she said, have been largely alone in fighting for their freedoms, and their struggle for equality makes this nation's true founding father, makes them this nation's true founding fathers. These assertions ignited a debate that is still raging a year later. Why so much controversy? The 1619 Project argues that the systemic racism that is slavery's legacy remains deeply rooted in every American institution and is still an ever-present factor in the lives of black Americans. The pessimism in that view has been assailed by critics such as City University of New York historian James Oakes. If racism is in this country's DNA, Oakes asked, what can you do? Alter your DNA? Critics particularly focused on Hannah Jones' claim that colonials rebelled partly out of fear England would outlaw slavery, noting that the abolitionist movement did not gain strength in England until a decade later, and that it was actually inspired by anti-slavery arguments in the U.S. Princeton historian Sean Willance demanded several factual corrections, contending that the framers left the word slavery out of the Constitution, not to erase the humanity of slaves, as Hannah Jones argued, but because they didn't want to validate slavery in national law. Who else attacked the Times? Many historians and scholars were critical of some of its claims, with conservatives rejecting its premise that slavery and racial oppression should be central themes in U.S. history. One highly visible attack came from inside the Times, with conservative columnist Brett Stevens writing last month that the project was simplistic and has failed to defend its most controversial assertions. Slavery was hardly unique to America, he said, noting that slave traders from Europe and other continents sold human beings, and that the odious practice was found throughout the Western Hemisphere. Though the founders were flawed, Stevens said, what made this country exceptional was not slavery, but America's revolutionary founding principle that all men are created equal, and its 250 years of struggling to realize its ideals. The 1619 Project has become a rallying cry on the right, with President Trump invoking it at the National Archives Museum in September, calling it an example of how the left has warped, distorted, and defiled the American story with deceptions, falsehoods, and lies. This summer, Senator Tom Cotton, a Republican from Arkansas, proposed a bill to bar federal funds from districts that incorporate the project into their history curriculum, saying it's meant to indoctrinate our kids to hate America. Does the Times defend its story? Yes, although the Times tweaked the text online. The paper issued a clarification stating that only some of the colonists revolted from Britain in order to protect slavery. Hannah Jones apologized for saying it was a primary motivation for the revolution, saying, I'm absolutely tortured by it. The paper also removed a phrase describing 1619 as the date of our true founding. But the Times by no means disowns its work. Publisher A.G. Sulzberger said the project's deep exploration of the lasting impact of slavery and racism is a journalistic triumph that changed the way millions of Americans understand our country. Jake Silverstein, editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine, says ongoing updates and the debate the project has inspired are a virtue, not a failure. Revision and clarification, he said, are important parts of historical inquiry. The 1619 Project in the Schools. The Pulitzer Center partnered with the Times to distribute teaching materials based on the 1619 Project, in more than 4,500 classrooms in all 50 states, from kindergarten to college, have crafted lessons using those resources. School systems in Buffalo, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Wilmington, Delaware, and Winston-Salem, North Carolina, incorporated the project more broadly into their history curriculum. In many districts, discussions of the role of slavery and racism in American history were previously very limited. In 2017, the Southern Poverty Law Center surveyed 1,700 social studies teachers nationwide, and 60% of them said their textbooks failed to adequately cover slavery. The SPLC survey showed, for example, that about 92% of high school students didn't even know that slavery was the main cause for the Civil War. American students are typically taught that slavery came and went, that it's a relic of our past, said Mark Schulte, the Pulitzer Center's education director. The 1619 Project shows its pernicious repercussions. Project editor Silverstein said, "It was never intended to replace all of U.S. history. It's being used as supplementary material." And we're into the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. The first, titled, "Why Trump is Terrified of Losing." "Losing re-election would be worse than a humiliation for Donald Trump," said Jane Mayer. "It could well mean a prison sentence. More than a dozen lawsuits and criminal investigations into Trump's finances are underway. Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. is overseeing a probe into Trump's possible complicity in the $130,000 payment to silence porn star Stormy Daniels, which already landed former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen in prison. Vance has broadened the investigation to encompass potentially illegal self-dealing in Trump's financial practices, including tax fraud, insurance fraud, and bank fraud. New York State Attorney General Letitia James is also hot on Trump's trail. While Trump could try to preemptively pardon himself or resign and have Vice President Mike Pence do it, the president can pardon only federal, not state, crimes. Some have suggested Trump might try to abscond abroad, yet he can't outrun his debts. In the next 4 years, Trump must meet payment deadlines for more than $300 million in loans he has personally guaranteed, and $900 million in real estate debt. The presidency has protected Trump from these grave legal and financial threats, but a reckoning may soon be coming. The bullying of the Girl Scouts. The Girl Scouts have learned the hard way that for the woke left, no institution can be non-combatant in the culture wars, said Christine Rosen. The organization last week tweeted out congratulations to Amy Coney Barrett for becoming the fifth woman appointed to the Supreme Court since its inception in 1789, with photos of all five, including the liberals Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan. The backlash was as swift and severe as it was bizarre. An indignant Representative Ayanna Pressley, the Democrat from Massachusetts, asked why the Scouts were uplifting a woman who is the antithesis of justice. A HuffPost.com editor warned the Girl Scouts not to celebrate someone as a hero to women simply because she identifies as a woman. Actresses, activists, and columnists piled on, excoriating the Scouts for promoting oppression by congratulating a conservative woman. The Scouts immediately caved to this bullying, deleting the Barrett tweet and meekly explaining that its nonpartisan mission was to lift up girls and women. In the past, Scouts have been a pretty woke group and have lavished praise on Ginsburg and Hillary Clinton. But for the cultural left, You're either fully on board or you're the enemy. This column comes from, this is from Brazil. It's the legacy of Hitler's loyalists. The Nazis who fled to Brazil after World War II seeded our country with their poisonous ideology, said Fabio Zanini. Neo-Nazism now flourishes in pockets across the nation, particularly in the state of Santa Catarina, which is known as Little Germany. In September, it was revealed that Wandersee Pugliese, a history professor who had a giant swastika painted on the bottom of his backyard swimming pool, was running on the center-left Liberal Party ticket in municipal elections in the Santa Catarina town of Pomerode. After an outcry, Pugliese's candidacy was withdrawn. But the mere possibility that a Nazi sympathizer could run for elective office shows the continuing strength of fascism in the state. Only last week, Daniela Reiner, the daughter of another Hitler-admiring history professor, was appointed Santa Catarina's interim governor. Nobody bothered to ask her whether she shares her father's views. Today, an estimated 500,000 people across Brazil consume neo-Nazi material, and ultra-right groups have seen their membership rocket since the 2018 election of far-right President Jair Bolsonaro. So far, says neo-fascism expert Adriana Dias, most neo-Nazi cells are isolated and operate only in their local communities. If they all communicated, she says, we would be lost. Moving into our long feature article, The Last Word. Title this week is Finding Solace in True Crime Shows. Taylor Schumann was wounded in a 2013 shooting at Virginia's New River Community College. Her recovery from trauma, Schumann said in Narratively.com, came with an unlikely aid. TV shows about violent crime. I sat on the couch under a white knitted blanket, my swollen hand propped up on the armrest with ice packs keeping the pain at bay. My husband, Eric, was holding the remote and clicking through the TV guide trying to find something that we both wanted to watch. We were on round four of binging Friends from beginning to end, and while he had been a trooper, he was kindly pleading with me to watch something else. Anything else. But anything else felt risky. Friends was familiar. I had already seen every episode. I didn't have to worry about surprises. There wouldn't be sudden loud noises piercing through the TV speakers. I didn't have to feel nervous when I pressed play. And I was nervous. It had been 6 months since a gunman had walked into the college I worked at and, out of misplaced anger and frustration at the world, pointed a gun at me and pulled the trigger. I was battling scenes of horror and darkness inside my own mind, replaying what had happened to me over and over again. So on TV, I wanted happy, easy, carefree. I wanted something that could remind me that the whole world wasn't terrifying all the time. In that moment, the idea of changing the channel instilled in me a sense of panic. I just wanted to feel comfort. And watching Ross and Rachel argue about being on a break for the fifth time had been doing it so far. But even I had to admit that it was getting old. So when Eric asked if we could watch something else, I said, sure, and tried to make it sound more convincing than it felt. I watched him as he landed on Dateline and looked over to get my approval. We used to watch this all the time, remember? Every Friday night. I nodded and thought back to all of the Friday nights in my college apartment when we would make taco salad and sit on the couch to watch the newest episode. But that was before I had two bullet holes in my hand. He noticed my hesitation. "If it's too much, we can change the channel," he said. I said it was okay, and he pressed the button on the remote that took us to the Investigation Discovery Channel. It was 2013, before podcasts like Serial and documentaries like Making a Murderer had taken over the cultural imagination. NBC's Dateline and ABC's 2020 were the kings of the true crime world, and you could find them 24 hours a day on Investigation Discovery. Dateline started, and we watched from the couch as the familiar formula played out. Crime, investigation, justice, overcoming. I felt my body tense up, and instinctively I pulled my shoulders closer to my ears. This was a bad idea, I thought to myself. I thought of all the triggers that were about to be thrown at me. It felt like I was walking through a field of landmines, holding my breath as I bypassed each one. As the minutes ticked by, slowly, I began to breathe again. And then it hit me. I was experiencing the show in a different way. Someone had been shot. I had been shot, too. People were talking to detectives. I had spoken with detectives, too. The victim was on the news. I had been on the news, too. The victim was afraid of everything. I was afraid, too. Victims were giving their impact statements to the court. I'd have to do that, too. The victim felt alone. I felt alone, too. I sat up straighter and leaned forward to concentrate, the way you do when you're driving and you're lost and you inexplicably turn down the music to see better. The noise I felt all around me was fading, and somehow I was seeing more clearly. I didn't feel anxious anymore. The show wasn't scaring me, it was comforting me. The show wasn't triggering me, it was calming me. I wasn't just watching someone else's story. I was watching my own. They were different, of course, but they were also the same. At the end of the show, the perpetrator was found guilty and the judge sentenced him to the maximum punishment. The victim recovered, and they showed her with her family, doing things she loved, living a normal life. It was, for lack of a better term, the perfect ending. And it was real. It made me think that maybe I could have a good ending, too. I didn't know anyone else who had been the victim of a violent crime, much less a school shooting. My late-night Google searches for shooting survivors support group near me always turned up empty. None of my friends knew what it was like to have a gun pointed at your face or to hide in a closet with blood pouring from your wounds, wondering if you would survive until help came. The harder I tried to find people in my life who could understand me, the more alone I felt. A man had used a gun to build a wall that separated me from everyone else, and it was up to me to figure out how to break it down. It became clear to me that while the round-the-clock viewing of feel-good shows like Friends and Parks and Recreation offered temporary relief, helping me relax enough to fall asleep, they also reminded me of a time and a life that didn't feel like my own anymore. Everything about them felt so far away from me and my experience. I didn't have a pretty bow tied up around my troubles at the end of each episode like they did. My problems were going to take longer than 23 minutes to fix. True crime shows, though, by the very name of their genre, were real. Often sensationalized, sure, but at their root was reality. Real people and real pain, just like my own. So I became obsessed, and it was easy to do. With the Investigation Discovery Channel at my fingertips, I could watch true crime 24 hours a day if I wanted to. On top of that, every Sunday, the Oxygen Channel ran a marathon of its signature crime show, Snapped. My family and close friends were concerned about my level of obsession and were afraid I wasn't healing. After all, who wants to sit around and watch depressing shows about murder and crime all day? They just don't get it, I would remind myself. Then, in 2014, Serial started a boom of true crime podcasts. Shows like In the Dark, Accused, Criminal, Crime Writers, On, Dirty John, and Bear Brook accompanied me as I cooked, bought groceries, drove around town, walked the dog, or did tasks around the house. The true crime boom extended to TV and streaming documentaries, too. Making a Murderer, The Keepers, The Jinx, Mommy Dead and Dearest, Amanda Knox, The Disappearance of Madeline McCann, Wild Wild Country, Evil Genius, Genius, Abducted in Plain Sight, The Confession Tapes. The list goes on. I welcome the popularization and therefore normalization of true crime genre for multiple reasons. First, I was no longer the weird one for watching murder shows all of the time. Second, as I chatted with friends about the popular documentaries and podcasts, the discussions often presented opportunities for me to share bits and pieces of my own experience that I hadn't felt comfortable or welcome sharing before. "I'm so sorry, I had no idea," they would say, and I felt more known. Third, I found an unexpected community of other victims of violent crime who also experienced a sort of mending of themselves through the true crime genre. After joining an online fan group for a popular podcast, True Crime Obsessed, I found a thread where people were sharing their stories about the things that had happened to them and about how listening to the podcast made them feel less alone, less different. "It's not just me," I thought. Nearly 6 years later, I was sitting once again on our red living room couch staring at the television. I was about to start another documentary, having recently been the subject of one myself. A reporter from the local news and her cameraman had come to our townhouse. The light they set up shone brightly in all directions. I felt like it might expose all of my deepest wounds for everyone to see. I spoke about what it was like to sit through the sentencing hearing of my shooter, awaiting a fitting punishment, and with it, some sense of justice. I talked about how I might begin to move on or find a new sense of normal, whatever that meant. I remembered how surreal it all felt in that moment. By that point, I'd seen so many interviews like this one. It was difficult to grasp that now I would be the one people were watching. I had a lot of memories like this where everything felt like I was standing on the outside, watching someone else's life. I came back to the present and quickly glanced at the baby monitor nearby to be sure that my six-month-old was asleep in his crib. And then I pressed play. The documentary, We Are Columbine, about one of the deadliest school shootings in the United States, began to play on the TV screen. I felt anxious about what I would see and nervous about the stories I would hear and what emotions they would bring to the surface for me. I wanted to watch it, though. Part of me felt obligated to. I knew how hard it was to open up about my story and expose those wounds for others to see. If these survivors were opening up to share the details of their most painful moments, then I could honor them by bearing witness. I knew I could watch it in a way other people couldn't. I could watch not for entertainment, but for solidarity. The documentary went back and forth from interviews with survivors to scenes from 1999. Students filing out of the school, hands above their heads, and tears streaming down their faces. I listen to their stories of trauma and loss as well as their stories of overcoming it. It was a form of therapy. Every face on the TV screen reminded me that there was a group of people out there in the world who felt the same things I did. And even though we would probably never meet in real life, somehow this genre could bring us together. When I felt isolated, alone, and forgotten, I could think of these people, the ones I hadn't met. Someone out there knew how I felt, and sometimes that could be enough. I didn't have to feel broken or dysfunctional when I couldn't walk through the grocery store or down the sidewalk without fearing every strange man I saw. My fears were justified. This was normal, I reminded myself. I felt hopeful seeing survivors leading happy lives and having fun with their children, because that meant that I could do that too. I felt less alone at the sight of survivors with physical injuries that hadn't and wouldn't heal. I was also living that life. Before the shooting, watching true crime shows was a diversion. Afterwards, it was no longer simply a genre to me. A true crime podcast playing through my earphones as I walk my dog isn't just a way to pass the time. It's a friend walking alongside me, reminding me that I'm not alone. Watching a new episode of Dateline on Friday night isn't just a way to be entertained for 2 hours each week. It's an offering of solidarity from someone who is going through it all too. And some days, that's all I need. This story was originally published in Narrativelly.com. Here's one of the obituaries for you this week. Sean Connery, 1930 to 2020. The suave Scotsman who made James Bond a screen icon. Sean Connery played dozens of roles in his long career, but was inextricably linked to one. The Scotsman found global stardom as James Bond, the suave British secret agent who dispatches evildoers with unerring aplomb, beds comely temptresses, and prefers his martinis shaken, not stirred. Starting with 1962's Dr. No and continuing in six more Bond films, Connery transformed the humorless protagonist of Ian Fleming's spy novels into a character who combined dashing sophistication with smoldering sexuality, sly wit, and an edge of menace. Other actors would take on the Bond mantle, but Connery remains the quintessential 007 to many fans. He brought his audience-pleasing magnetism to other celebrated parts, playing a roguish British soldier in The Man Who Would Be King from 1975, a street-smart Chicago beat cop in The Untouchables, 1987, and a Soviet submarine captain in The Hunt for Red October, 1990. Connery looks absolutely confident in himself as a man. Critic Pauline Kael once wrote, "Women want to meet him, and men want to be him." Thomas Sean Connery grew up in Edinburgh slum, where the dueling aromas of a rubber factory and a brewery hung over the streets, said the Washington Post. His father was a truck driver and his mother was a maid. Connery dropped out of school at 12, and after working as a milkman, bricklayer, and lifeguard, he served 2 years in the Royal Navy. He then trained as a furniture polisher and took a job at a funeral parlor nailing coffins. In his downtime, he lifted weights and posed as a life model at an art school. At the urging of a fellow weightlifter, he headed to London to enter a Mr. Universe contest, a trip with a life-altering outcome, said the Los Angeles Times. Hearing of a casting call for a touring production of South Pacific, He auditioned and was hired as a chorus member. On tour, he worked his way up to a small speaking role, and under the tutelage of an American castmate, began consuming the works of Shakespeare, Ibsen, Joyce, and Tolstoy. Reading, Connery later said, can change one's life. I'm the living evidence. When he returned to London, small stage and TV roles followed, as did minor film parts. Then came Dr. No, said the Daily Telegraph. Casting the unknown Connery was a gamble, but the producers were taken with the actor's self-confidence. Bond creator Fleming, who initially felt Connery was too rough-edged for the debonair spy, was won over by his girlfriend's enthusiasm. The movie was a sensation, said the Times. With its fast cars, tropical locales, and glamorous women, Dr. No thrilled audiences around the world. Connery was the top box office star in the U.S. and U.K. in 1965, after the success of Bond sequels From Russia with Love, Goldfinger, and Thunderball. But by 1967's You Only Live Twice, he felt boxed in by the role. The first two or three were fun, he said. Jumping out of planes was entertaining, although it was tough on my hairpiece. Taking a break from Bond, he greatly expanded his repertoire, appearing in commercial hits and art house flops. In the 1970s and 80s, said the New York Times, Connery gracefully transformed himself into one of the grand old men of the movies. It helped that his magnetism did not fade. In 1989, at age 59, he was named People's Sexiest Man Alive. Connery, who bypassed Hollywood for homes in Spain and the Bahamas, was darker and more complex off camera. Fearful of being cheated, he brought endless lawsuits against producers and others, though he also gave massive sums to charity. His first two wives, Diane Cilento, wrote a memoir in which she accused him of abusing her mentally and physically, claims Connery denied. He made his last film in 2003, said Reuters.com. He retired after feuding with the director and pronouncing himself fed up dealing with idiots. Despite his success, Connery was unromantic about the actor's lot, calling it a job like being a bricklayer. Keeping a level head was key to his success, he said in 1987. My strength as an actor, I think, is that I've stayed close to the core of myself. And we'll go right on over to the Talking Points page with COVID's winter surge, the dark days ahead. Winter is coming. Words health experts have been dreading since the start of the pandemic, said Megan McArdle in the Washington Post. As they feared, the arrival of November has seen COVID-19 infections exploding in large swaths of the country, with the U.S. reporting just under 100,000 new cases Friday, capping a record-shattering week that put total cases above 9,375,000 and deaths near 230,000. More than 40,000 people are hospitalized, and deaths are climbing back to 1,000 a day. Infections are spiraling out of control as the worst possible time, as cold weather forces people into enclosed places with poor ventilation, where the virus spreads most easily. Tens of millions of stir-crazy Americans will be tempted to break quarantine together with family for Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Hanukkah, potentially endangering relatives and accelerating the gathering new wave. Dr. Deborah Birx, the White House Coronavirus Task Force coordinator, has issued a blunt warning, said Cheryl Gay Stolberg and Maggie Haberman in the New York Times. In an uncharacteristic break from President Trump, Birx last week told the White House and state governors that the social distancing and mask wearing needed to curb infections are not being implemented. The U.S., she said, is entering the most concerning and most deadly phase of this pandemic. There's no cause for panic, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. While the 7-day U.S. average of new cases has nearly doubled from the recent low in mid-September, the nation is much better prepared to respond than it was in the spring. Hospitalizations are up by about 40% since September, but are still 30% or so below the spring and summer peaks. And doctors are better equipped to help patients recover with therapeutic medications and low-flow oxygenation in lieu of invasive ventilation. Thanks to these medical advances, death rates have fallen tremendously. In hot spots like El Paso, Texas, federal and state officials have been quick to establish alternate care sites and send extra critical care personnel. A cold weather surge was inevitable, but we are fully capable of coping with the COVID winter while we wait for the arrival of vaccines in early 2021. Tell that to Americans staring down financial ruin, said Jeff Stein in the Washington Post. About 90% of the $2.7 trillion in federal pandemic aid passed this spring has already been dispersed, and Congress and the White House have failed to negotiate additional relief. As a result, millions of Americans risk having their power and water shut off with unpaid utility bills coming due, while protections for renters, student borrowers, and jobless Americans will expire by the end of the year, absent federal action. With colder weather likely to limit outdoor dining, 40% of all restaurant owners say they expect to go under by March, as would an estimated 66% of U.S. hotels. A Trump administration eviction moratorium for renters expires December 31st, putting 30 million to 40 million Americans at risk of eviction. And sorry to leave you without the quote this week, but we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.